So imagine your phone is ringing.
Oh no.
Yeah, right? It's your biggest client, and they are, I mean, they are absolute furious.
Is the worst sound in the world.
It really is. So you are holding the phone like away from your ear while they yell, and you look across the office at the employee who just caused this massive disaster.
Let me guess, they have no idea.
Zero idea. They are grinning. They are completely convinced they just hit a home run, you know? They have no clue they are leaving a trail of absolute wreckage in their wake.
Oh, wow. Yeah, welcome to the ultimate leadership nightmare.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, it is the most intense stress test a manager can face, especially today, right? Because as modern leaders, we're basically hardwired to use a coaching mindset,
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we're taught to be empathetic.
right? We are trained to hold space, to lean in, to ask open-ended questions. We want to guide people to discover their own solutions.
Right.
But what do you actually do when the employee literally lacks the vocabulary or really the self-awareness to even find that answer?
You realize you simply cannot coach someone into competence they don't yet possess.
Exactly. You just can't.
Which honestly brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. For you listening, we are exploring this brilliant piece of source material by Lissa DeHart and Jake Menino.
It's so good.
It really is, and it's appropriately titled, You Can't Coach What They Don't Know They're Doing. So today, we are handing you a highly concrete framework for handling deeply unaware, underperforming team members.
Because, look, relying on gentle corporate buzzwords, it's just not going to save you when the house is actively burning down.
No, it's really not.
And the authors, they lay down this harsh truth right at the start. Having these conversations, it requires grit.
Yeah, it's not easy.
It takes a massive amount of courage and, well, chutzpah, to sit across from a human being who thinks they are just thriving and basically tell them their approach is fundamentally broken.
But avoiding that confrontation doesn't make the wreckage disappear.
Not at all. It just forces the rest of your team to sit there and watch the collateral damage spread.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before you can step in and neutralize a problem on your team, you first have to actually diagnose the specific anatomy of that problem,
All right,
right?
you need to know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, because not all struggles are created equal. And the authors pull in this really fascinating framework from a military general who basically categorized everyone in an organization into four distinct types.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is how this military framework, it just completely strips away all the corporate fluff.
Oh, totally.
It forces you to look at raw behavioral output. So the general's first category is the smart and lazy employee.
Ah, yes, we all know one.
Right. These individuals have all the capability in the world, but they figure out the absolute most efficient way to do the bare minimum.
It is such a frustrating waste of potential, honestly.
It is, but they generally aren't causing active harm to the broader organization.
Right, they stay in their lane. I mean, they were infuriating to manage, but the damage is contained.
Exactly. Then you have the second type, which is smart and industrious.
The unicorn.
The unicorn, the dream employee. They have high capability, high drive, and everybody fights to get them on their team.
Yeah, obviously.
And the third type is not smart and lazy.
Okay, so what does that look like?
Well, you know exactly what you were getting here. They show up, they do their mundane tasks slowly, and they go home.
Right.
Nothing truly innovative is ever going to happen with them, but nothing catastrophic is going to happen either. They are just a known, predictable quantity.
Which brings us to the fourth type. And honestly, just hearing you describe this high activity, bad outcome person, I am actually getting a stress response right now just picturing it.
Yeah, it's intense.
The fourth type is not smart and industrious.
These are the individuals who literally cause leaders to wake up in a cold sweat at 3 a.m.
Oh, without a doubt.
because they operate with boundless enthusiasm and extremely high activity levels, but they consistently produce destructive outcomes.
Yeah, they are doing a massive amount of work.
Exactly. But almost all of it is actively damaging your organization.
You know that fourth type? It sounds exactly like a toddler with a hammer.
Oh, that is the perfect analogy.
Right. They have this endless energy, and their intentions might even be entirely pure, right? I mean, they want to help build the house.
Right, they think they're helping.
But they are causing maximum collateral damage everywhere they swing that hammer. But I have to ask, you know, is it really fair for a leader to classify people this bluntly in their heads?
It feels harsh, right?
It does. Labeling someone as not smart feels like a pretty harsh judgment on their actual character.
This raises an important question, and I mean, it is a trap that empathetic leaders constantly fall into. we have to clearly separate the human being from the output.
Okay, so how do we do that?
Well, when the general says not smart, we are not talking about a person's IQ or their inherent worth as a human. We are talking about a severe deficit in situational awareness.
Got it.
It is the inability to connect their immediate actions to the broader downstream consequences.
Yeah.
So diagnosing that toddler with a hammer behavior, it's strictly a clinical starting point.
It's just a way to figure out the right conversation.
Exactly. It tells you whether this person needs highly prescriptive training or whether they are, you know, a wonderful human just sitting in the wrong seat, or honestly, whether you need to prepare for an exit. You just cannot treat the disease until you boldly name it.
That makes a lot of sense. But diagnosing the toddler with a hammer is really only half the battle, right?
True.
Because if you intervene every single time they take a swing, you just become a micromanager.
Right. Nobody wants that.
So the real question is, how do you know when a standard mistake has mutated into a fatal flaw? And the authors use this incredible visualization about poisonous berries.
Yeah, this is brilliant. So imagine your team is a small, ancient tribe of gatherers.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Someone goes out foraging, comes back to camp, and drops a handful of poisonous berries right into the communal pile.
Yikes. Okay.
But you don't instantly banish them into the wilderness, right?
Yeah.
You assume a lack of knowledge.
Yeah, you give them the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. You sit them down, you show them exactly what the good, nutritious berries look like versus the toxic ones. You retrain them, and you send them back out.
Because a mistake is just a mistake the first time.
Right. But what happens when they go out the next day and the day after that, and they just keep bringing back those exact same poisonous berries?
Yeah, that is definitely no longer a mistake.
Exactly. That is a fatal pattern. And the critical insight from the source here is that this pattern, it doesn't happen in a vacuum.
No, everyone sees it.
Right, the entire tribe is sitting around the campfire staring at this growing pile of toxic fruit.
So they are watching the bad berry picker, but more importantly, they are watching you as the leader.
Spot on. They are actively losing trust in their peer. But the moment you, the leader, keep sending that person back into the woods without intervening,
yeah,
the tribe's trust in you evaporates completely.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy.
It is. The author shared this piece of granddad wisdom from one of their clients, and I love this. If you are heading in the wrong direction, stop walking.
Just stop walking. I love that. Start picking the poisonous berries.
Exactly.
But, you know, I know what you are thinking listening to this right now. You are thinking, wait, if I just step in and unilaterally tell them to start picking the berries, aren't I violating the golden rule of coaching?
Right. The empathy pushback.
Yeah. Aren't I just dictating and micromanaging at that point?
It's a fair question, but the open-ended coaching approach entirely collapses in this specific scenario.
Why is that?
Because coaching relies on a fundamental assumption. It assumes that the other person possesses the underlying insight to find the right answer if you just prompt them correctly.
Oh, I see.
You cannot pull an answer out of an empty vessel. Asking how did gathering those berries make you feel?
Right.
Asking that to someone who lacks the basic situational awareness to even recognize poison is totally futile.
Especially after you have already tried retraining them once.
Exactly.
Right.
Leadership occasionally requires direct, unambiguous intervention.
Yeah.
Choosing inaction because you are afraid of looking like a micromanager sends a devastating message to your high performers. It essentially tells them that competence doesn't actually matter to you.
That is such a powerful point. So you see the poisonous berries piling up. You realize the Socratic method is completely failing.
Yep.
You know you must intervene to save the tribe's trust.
Hmm.
But rushing into the room hot guarantees a spectacular failure.
Oh, absolutely.
The authors highlight this massive blind spot in most leadership advice, which is the pre-conversation.
Yes, the most skipped step. When you get that furious phone call from a client about the wreckage your employee just caused, your body undergoes a physiological hijack.
Yeah, your blood is boiling.
Right. Your amygdala fires. It floods your system with cortisol and adrenaline. You will feel this physical knot of anxiety or just a spike of pure anger.
Oh, I've been there.
If you march over to their desk while running on that chemical cocktail, you will escalate the situation instead of resolving it. You absolutely must regulate yourself first.
You have to sting away.
Yes. You have to physically step away and let your prefrontal cortex, your logic and reasoning center, turn back on before you initiate any contact.
And the authors provide a golden rule for what absolutely not to say once your logic center is back online.
Right.
Under no circumstances should you ever use the phrase, "We need to talk."
It is a conversational hand grenade.
It really is. Here's where it gets really interesting for me. Saying, "We need to talk," is exactly like playing that ominous cello music in a horror
Oh,
movie.
totally. Da-na-da-da-da-da.
Exactly. You haven't even shown the monster on screen yet, but the audience's brain is already flooding with adrenaline preparing for a jump scare. When you drop, "We need to talk," on an employee, their defenses go up instantly. They can't hear anything else you say because they are just bracing for impact.
They assume the absolute worst. Their psychological armor locks into place, their weapons arm, and you haven't even booked the conference room yet.
So, the alternative the source suggests is actually highly structured. You reach out and provide context immediately.
Right, don't leave them guessing.
Right. Something like, "Hey, I just got some feedback from a customer that I need to share and discuss with you. Can we meet at 2 p.m. today?"
Yes, perfect.
You give them the reason and you give them a minimum of 2 hours, up to 24 hours, to downshift. But I really have to push back on this timeline a bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
If I message someone at 10 a.m. saying, "We are meeting at 2 p.m. to discuss customer feedback," aren't they just gonna sweat and panic and overthink for 4 agonizing hours?
Look, it is a valid fear, but we have to look at the neurobiology of how humans process unexpected stress.
Okay, how so?
Most people do not think fast enough to absorb hard, critical feedback right on the spot. If you ambush them at their desk and they blow up or get fiercely defensive,
Which happens a lot.
it does. And it's usually because they literally have not had the time to process what they're even feeling.
Yeah.
Yes, they might sweat a bit for those 4 hours, but you are intentionally managing the speed of the interaction. Adrenaline has a half-life. You are giving them the necessary time to move through that initial instant spike of panic, which allows them to arrive in the room with a mindset capable of actual dialogue.
Rather than just primitive fight or flight,
Exactly.
you are giving them a grace period to put their own armor away before they walk through your door.
You are manufacturing an environment where the conversation actually has a mathematical chance of succeeding.
Okay, I love that. So the clock strikes 2 p.m. You are emotionally regulated. They have survived the adrenaline spike and downshifted. The door closes. What actually happens when you sit down?
So the very first requirement is that you, the leader, must explicitly know your goal before you even open your mouth.
You have to have the plan.
Right. Are you dealing with a first-time offense where your only goal is building awareness, like, hey, these are the poisonous berries, let's review the good ones?
Okay, sure.
Or is this the fourth time and your goal is fundamentally assessing if they are in the wrong seat entirely? You cannot steer the conversation if you don't know the destination.
That makes perfect sense. And the authors really emphasize that specificity is your only shield against defensiveness.
Oh, absolutely.
You just cannot use vague corporate speak. Telling an unaware employee, "You really need to do better," or "You need to step up," it means absolutely nothing to them.
Because they already think they're stepping up.
Exactly. You have to focus entirely on the behavior, not the person's character. Use the exact words the customer used.
Yes.
And the source notes, you don't need to read them a laundry list of 12 failures. Two or three highly specific examples are more than enough to anchor the reality.
Because specificity removes the wiggle room. If you try to debate their intent, you will lose, because most people do not intend to cause a disaster.
Right. Their intentions were likely good.
Exactly. But if you focus relentlessly on the impact, the specific action they took, and the specific wreckage it caused, you ground a conversation in undeniable facts.
There is this incredible anecdote in the source material that really highlights the energy you bring into this room.
Oh, the pushback guy's story.
Yes. It involves a leader who is just dreading a conversation with an employee he internally referred to as the pushback guy.
Which tells you everything you need to know right there.
Right. This was a direct report who was about to miss his quarterly bonus because he completely missed his targets, and the leader just knew it was going to be a miserable, argumentative fight.
Leader was already putting on his own armor, just bracing for a hostile negotiation.
But before the meeting, the leader forced an internal shift. Instead of going in defensively, ready to parry every argument, he decided his primary goal was, "I actually want him to get his bonuses. I want him to be successful."
That is a huge shift.
Massive. He walked into that room with the genuine energy of an ally, and the entire dynamic shifted. By staying in a "help me help you" posture, they mapped out new targets together without a single raised voice.
Wow.
I mean, it might not have been a fun celebratory meeting, but it was incredibly productive.
That ally energy just alters the entire frequency of the conversation. There's immense power in acknowledging the difficulty out loud.
Like just naming the awkwardness.
Yeah, saying, you know, this is going to be a tough conversation and we might both leave feeling a bit deflated, but my goal is to work together to fix this.
Right.
That level of candor lowers the temperature immediately. It proves to the employee that you aren't sitting across the table to attack them. You are sitting next to them to attack the problem.
That is so good. So what does this all mean for the final piece of this framework, which is the documentation?
Ah, yes. The dreaded paperwork.
Because honestly, I hear document the conversation and it instantly feels gross. It feels clinical, like you are quietly building a legal case against someone behind their back.
I hear that a lot.
How do you balance being a genuine, transparent ally in the room with keeping a paper trail?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of organizational health, that gross feeling usually fades.
Okay, explain that for me.
Because here's the brutal reality of corporate life. If it is not documented, the conversation did not happen. Yes, human resources and legal departments require it for liability cover, sure. But purely from a leadership perspective, documentation is the only thing that prevents the toxic cycle of bad behavior continuing unchecked.
That's a good point.
We have all witnessed the corporate tour of wreckage, right? An employee causes absolute chaos. No manager has the courage to officially write it down. And a year later, that same employee gets transferred or promoted to another department.
Taking all their poisonous berries with them.
Exactly. Documenting reality is an act of ultimate protection for your team, for yourself, and for the ecosystem of the entire company.
It stops the wreckage from going on tour. It forces actual accountability into the system.
100%.
Let's bring this all together for you listening, because this is really a massive paradigm shift. If you've got someone creating a mess while smiling obliviously, you have to temporarily throw out the open-ended coaching playbook.
Throw it right out.
First, diagnose your employee type. Are you dealing with the toddler with the hammer? Second, separate the one-time mistakes from the fatal patterns. And remember, your entire tribe is watching how you handle those poisonous berries.
They see everything.
Third, regulate your own amygdala before you trigger their horror movie defenses with, "We need to talk." Give them the time to process the stress.
A crucial step.
Fourth, walk into the room as an ally, armed with undeniable, specific behavioral examples. And finally, write it down so the wreckage stops with you.
It really is a masterclass in handling the darkest corners of management.
Oh.
But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final, larger question to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've spent this entire time dissecting how to manage that not smart and industrious person once they're already inside your house, causing havoc.
Right.
But take a hard look at your broader organization. If your company consistently hires, or worse, consistently promotes this high activity, bad outcome type of person, what is the systemic poisonous berry in your company's culture that makes those toddlers with hammers look like star candidates in the very first place?
Oh, wow. Yeah, if the system actively rewards the toddler with the hammer, the problem is vastly bigger than one unaware employee.
Exactly.
That is a brilliant thought to leave on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the limits of the empathy toolkit. Next time you see that absolute wreckage piling up, remember, you can't coach what they don't know, but you absolutely can manage it. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.